Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
And welcome to another edition of Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. And we have some real big thinkers here today. We have, if you walk in here carrying a PhD, we know you're a big thinker. And so we'll get that out of the way right away. Mr. Muhammad Abdurrahman, how are you doing?
I'm happy. How are you?
I'm happy. And we'll come back to you later. But first, we have to introduce Brianna McCullough, who she's a senior engineer at Target Corporation. And I'm not exactly sure what a senior engineer is, but you've got to be smart to do that.
I would say I am pretty smart.
Okay, well, that makes two out of three. So let's start with just a little brief story about how you got to be where you are. Muhammad, you're not only a highly educated scholar in linguistics, you're also on your second startup you're working on now?
I mean, it depends on how you classify your first or second startup. I'd say it's like my third startup in the last since 2010 or something. Or
wow. Death.
But I started my first business when I was a kid. So
how old?
Well, depending on how you count it, I started.
Age?
Yeah. I mean, I started selling stuff when I was really small. But then I had to learn about, property rights and things like that.
Oh, you took somebody else's property and tried to sell it?
No, just stuff around the house.
Okay. Yeah. Things from your family.
Yeah, yeah.
Did this business have a name?
No. I was like four. I didn't understand what I was doing.
Well, you started early. Yeah.
You have the entrepreneurial gene.
Yeah, I've got a few genes.
Okay. So we see where you began with your entrepreneurship. How did you get into linguistics?
So when I was in college, somebody actually called me a linguist, and I didn't know what the word meant, and I thought I was actually being made fun of, and I reacted pretty negatively to it. But 9/11 happened while I was in school, and I was just beginning college. When it happened, I was a finance major, so I was convinced I was going to go off to Goldman and then maybe either do some IB, like investment banking, venture capital type of stuff.
You're going to be a capitalist.
Or start companies or both. And I actually complained a lot about not having an entrepreneurship program at my alma mater back then. But when 9/11 hit, I saw the president, George W. Bush. And I was at Morehouse College, which is an all-male school. It's all-black, all-male school. Two white guys in my freshman class.
Huh.
When George W. stood on the rubble and said, we need help. We're gonna go do this. I said, we need linguists. And I've got family in New York and D.C. And I knew that 9/11 was going to mean a lot for the country, but as a young brown guy with a fully Arabic name, I knew that it was going to mean a lot for me and how I lived and was perceived in the world. So I was pretty upset over that. And so when he said we need linguists, I just finished studying German and I took Latin when I was in high school and I had a talent for this kind of thing. And so I said, you know what? You can't give me an M16. I'm a scrawny guy, but I'll be all about code and all about language and all of that.
So, wow! So you're like a patriotic guy.
I mean, I, I'm not. I'm not. I'm not. I was at an all male school. The testosterone was bananas. You got under like you remember that day, right? Uh-huh. That was right. Crazy. And so no, like I said, my family. I've got family in D.C. and New York. So in that moment, it was pretty visceral.
Wow. So now, Brianna, that's quite a story. How did you get into be a
listen? I don't think I'm going to be able to stand up to that, but. So when I first went to college, and I was actually studying to be a doctor. So, oh. Yeah. So ever since I was a kid, like preschool, I was kind of positioned to go into the physical sciences. So human biology is what I originally started studying in college and undergrad. And I started interning, you know, and I had kind of understood in freshman, sophomore year that I wasn't going to continue on the medical track. It just wasn't for me. And I felt like the people who were doing it loved it. So they put in all the time and effort. And I didn't see that in myself. I just knew that that wasn't something I was willing to do. And then when you tack on the fact that it requires extra schooling to move forward with it, I was just like, you know, if I'm going to go to school or graduate program, it's going to be for something that I want to do and not to add on to this degree to call myself a doctor. So I said, forget that. Like, I'm moving on. And I started interning. So I got my internship and I went to D.C. for a year and interned under the Michigan State University Study Away program, which was life changing. Totally did a 360, a pivot. And I did research while I was there at Georgetown Lombardi Cancer Center on pancreatic cancer. So when during that time, I was working with medical students, right? Because I was still technically on a medical track. And I was the only brown girl of the group. There were three other girls that I did it with, but definitely the only brown person. And I was more concerned with the technology more than I was concerned with
the
people. Yeah, with the people and actually doing the work. Yeah, and the lab work and the blood work and stuff like that. Like, I didn't really have a knack for that. Like, I didn't have a natural instinct for that kind of work. So after that, I started working with some of the technicians that were working at the hospital and kind of, like, went away from the group. So I was that nerd who was, like, more concerned with how things worked, like the radiation machines and the Georgetown was one of the only hospitals using CyberKnife radiation at that time.
Well, cyber what?
CyberKnife radiation.
What's that?
Yeah, it's a radiation. So I don't want to get too far into it, but pancreatic cancer.
Well, Muhammad, he can understand it.
Yeah,
no.
He'll explain it to me.
At first, I thought you said cybernetic, and I was like, "Whoa,
no, okay. CyberKnife
Skynet over here fighting pancreatic cancer."
No, CyberKnife radiation is a
CyberKnife.
Gotcha.
Okay, CyberKnife.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a special radiation
It cuts through stuff?
No, it's radiation. So it's uses.
Yeah, but like a super laser kind of radiation, right? Man,
but it was what they were using at for pancreatic cancer. Pancreatic cancer has a 5% survival rate. So FYI, yeah, it's literally when once you're diagnosed from that time.
So they call out the big guns, so to speak.
Yeah, it is. It really requires. Fast moving. After 5 years, like most people don't survive beyond 5 years, even with radiation treatment and things of that nature. So it's really was an accelerated program for me. And after that, I actually continued on the medical track and graduated with a Bachelor's of Science and taught myself how to code.
Really?
So what most people don't know about me, a lot of people think I have a computer science degree. I don't. I have a Bachelor's of Science, but it's not in computer science.
Oh, that coding. You can learn it on your own.
Yeah.
Well, what about you? Do you learn coding or do you know that?
Yeah. I learned it when I was – So I studied some computer science and programming mostly by myself or with like a mentor or something like that.
Now, is this when you were four?
Well, no. I was on a Commodore 64 when I was four.
Okay.
Or six or something like that. Do you know Commodore 64?
No. Well, it's an old computer, right?
Yeah, it's a really old computer.
Pre-Apple?
Yeah, well, it's around contemporary.
Right.
I remember when we got a mouse in my house, a clickable one. But no, I was trying to figure out what to do with BASIC when I was like six, and that was super frustrating.
So you were an early you're a prodigy.
No, I'm not, because I really sucked at it. Can I say that?
Yes, I think you just did.
My bad. Okay.
We'll go with it.
Sorry about that. I was really bad at it. And I didn't have anybody in my home who could teach me about it. My dad sold computers,
but he didn't fix them.
Yeah, he wasn't a programmer. So I was kind of on my own, and, you know, kids have a limit. And so I had a limit. But no, I taught myself some stuff. I taught myself some PHP, MySQL, Python.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had
When I was six, I think I had a stick and some wooden blocks, and that
yeah,
was about it.
Me too. Yeah. I was more interested. So back then, I thought I was going to be like a model or something. Oh. Like, I was really, really interested in like physical beauty. Like, so I don't even think being a coding person would have never crossed my mind. I would have never thought of myself as an engineer ever.
See,
like,
but now you both code, and I would have no idea how to do it.
I haven't. I mean, my code, the last time I really got paid for my hard code was a while back. The problem with building an organization from the ground up and it growing up is the moment you start bringing on other engineers who are entirely dedicated to that, your skills start to atrophy.
Because you give them the assignment and you do the larger scale thinking.
Exactly. And so it's kind of like I wouldn't be surprised if you talked like, okay, so you've had a very prolific career, right? And there's a lot of things that you would have done day to day when you first came out of college that you wouldn't do now because the technology's changed, the times have changed.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I wrote code in Python 2. Whatever that's completely useless now. I wrote because we're on 3.14, right? So I have to change that code in order for it to even work. So my what I would normally do, like the system still work, mm-hmm. like URLs are still URLs, and the internet still works the same way, which is kind of weird, actually, when you mm-hmm. think about it. But the languages that you use to do that, and even some of the constructs that you use, have changed.
Well, it's like your consciousness is still the same, but the concepts are different.
Yeah, more
or
less.
Think about the ideas are evolving.
I think the way that code is being processed is a lot different, too, and that's why the versions are being upticked every single time. I write code for a living. I do a lot of network automation. That's what I work with. Stores hosting, we manage the servers that applications actually run on. So, like, yes, it's very complex kind of work, but I enjoy it. I've had the opportunity. I've only been at Target for 6 months, so I came from 3M.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So. Is that a step down or a step up?
Step up. I love Target. I love 3M, too. They're both great companies. I got lucky.
But at 3M, if they give you an employee discount, what do you get, a percentage off scotch tape?
And yes.
But at Target, you can buy all this stuff.
Don't underestimate the power of a good post-it note.
Yeah, seriously. Especially if you work in an agile environment for the agile people out there.
Boy,
post-it notes go
that's
far.
That's one of the top words now is agile.
Yeah.
I don't know if you use it a lot, but it means that you can turn around quickly and respond to things. And well, you're working, well, Target and 3M, those are big companies are famous for not being able to do that. It's like a battleship needing to, you know, make a sharp left.
Yeah, it's terrifying when
MVPs.
Big companies start doing that because it makes it harder for startups to eat up their market.
So huge. You don't want them to move around.
Yeah, and cool. 3M is just, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's going through an agile transformation right now. Target went through an agile transformation a couple of years ago. So we are completely agile.
What does that mean? Does that mean they can actually change
MVP.
A product?
Fail fast, fail quickly, move forward, basically.
Wow.
We take small chunks of work and turn it into MVP, which is the most viable product that we can push to the market quickly.
So if there's a children's toy that does something wrong, you can go in and fix it. You're in tune with the kids?
Right? Basically, long story short, it's a way that you're constantly producing. You're constantly deploying code.
Hmm.
You're constantly pushing code to production market in order to, you know, fix bugs, make our systems run better. It's MVP, most viable product. So not, it's finished in its entirety, but no, we have a piece of work that we want to push to production.
Well, see, that fits in the MVP because I know at Target they call their employees our team, right?
Yes.
So it's like MVP and, hey, I scored.
Yeah.
It's a little bit different from that. So if they were to apply MVP to their team, then, I mean, they might have layoffs on a semi-regular basis based on performance.
That encourages the hero mentality.
Target's a phenomenal company, and it's a pleasure to you know live in its halo here in the Twin Cities.
Well, I actually worked for Target when it was still Dayton's.
Wow,
I was a bill collector.
Yeah,
I was looking for a job indoors, and they had nice air conditioning. This is way back when, before I got into media.
Yeah, I think the way to think about MVP, minimal viable product, is to look at it from a perspective of you want to talk with the user, understand what their needs are, and then start iterating, like trying to solve their issues one issue at a time. Mm-hmm. And once you get to a point where you've satisfied with the need, great, you've got something that works. Are they willing to pay for it? Yes. Okay, great. Now we can start talking about everything else. But
now it's viable.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it sounds like what I've heard about design thinking.
Yeah, they're very related.
But they're not the same?
I just wanted to speak to MVP. I think that what was happening before people started moving to Agile is that we were taking too much time trying to build things. Mm. And by the time we were able to deliver, there would have been a startup or someone to come along and steal that customer from us.
Mahama did it.
Yeah.
You betcha.
So I think by moving to an Agile environment, what's happening now is it's kind of like the opposite. We're moving so quickly. And even though startups are just moving just as fast, but we're not giving them the opportunity to come in and steal those customers as commonly as it was happening before we moved into an Agile environment.
Well, I mean, the ideal situation, even for a lot of startups, is not to grab market share. I'm just kind of playing the game there. But, mm-hmm. you know, when there can be a collaboration between an early stage company and a more established company, really awesome things can happen. Like, really awesome things can happen.
Well, isn't that the point of Target Techstars? Well, here's the story I heard. Maybe you can alter that. I don't know what you've learned in your 6 months there, but I heard that there tried to be an innovation center in Target, mm-hmm. and it didn't work for some reason. I don't know if it was just vetoed or what, but now they turn outside for innovation and find these startups and kind of foster them in their tech accelerator or retail accelerator. Uh-huh.
And they just launched another one.
And then they buy these companies. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to kind of have the best of both, right? You can be big and agile and then get some new blood in.
And it depends on what kind of startup person you want to be, if you want to be bought. You know, a lot of startups want to be private. They don't want to be bought by these bigger companies. They want to go on and see their company grow as a standalone, not be bought under a big corporation.
Right. Some startups have their exit plan at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Is that your attitude, Mohammed?
You know, beginning with the end in mind is a well-exercised trope. So I would say that if you know where you're going when you set out on your journey, you probably have a better chance of getting there than if you just start wandering. Like if I were to say, hey, Steve, let's get on a plane. And you say, where are we going? I said, I don't know, but I hope, you know, I think we'll go somewhere great. I don't think you get on the plane with me. You'd wonder how much fuel the plane has, right? But if I said, hey, we're going to Cleveland, then you could decide whether or not you even wanted to go to Cleveland.
Right.
Right? It's the same with a startup.
Huh. But the thing is, the ideal, like you've been in developing products that help people.
Yes.
It could be my goal is to help people rather than my goal is to help people and then sell it and fly to Cleveland.
Well, that's it. What are you going to do? We're flying to Cleveland. Nothing wrong with Cleveland. I got friends in Cleveland. But, I mean, that's not like, you know, going to Disneyland or something.
But the point is you don't have to think about selling it right away.
No, you don't. I mean, and, you know, honestly, some of the best companies I've encountered, the founders are just – they just want to solve a problem. And they're so about solving that problem that they don't really even have time to think that much about the money. Some of them are pressured into figuring out the money because they're talking to, you know, venture capitalists or angels who want to see where their return's going to come from. But I've seen some amazing products that where the revenue model was kind of an afterthought.
Hmm.
I don't happen to believe in that myself.
Do you have an exit plan?
Always.
Okay.
I mean,
I have an exit plan to myself. We're going to pause right here and then come back here on Synapse Think Tank of the Air talking with Brianna McCullough and Mohammed Abdurrahman.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back, Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, and we're thinking left and right here. Boy, talking about agility and agile thinking, design thinking, all those things. We're here with Brianna McCullough, who's a senior engineer at Target. And you don't get to work downtown. You work at Brooklyn Park?
Yeah, so I always tell people they keep all the nerds and IT professionals like me and hidden away.
Hidden away from the retail folks.
Yeah, they keep me hidden away. So I am a nerd, and I hate using that word, but I am. I'm very interested in nerdery.
Nerds Anonymous.
I'm a geek.
Yeah.
And I own it. I'm founding geek and organizer for a meetup group called Geeks for Good. We're the largest technology group for socially minded people in certainly Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
We only have about 350 folks, but we're still new.
That sounds good.
Yeah. So
Muhammad Abdurrahman, you're not tucked away in Brooklyn Park. You're actually tucked away in two different places.
Yeah, so we were talking about that before we got started. So so my company, Clutch, we're in the Lunar Startups Incubator in downtown St. Paul on Osborne 370, which has a lot of really great startups in it, including Techstars Farm to Fork.
It's the hot new thing. It's the place to be, isn't it?
I mean, it's pretty sweet, actually. It's got really great. It's beautiful.
They just painted it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just finished it off. It's the old Ecolab building down on Wabasha.
Oh.
And then my company, we actually started off in WeWork here in Minneapolis in Capella Tower.
On this very block.
On this block.
In the CCO studios.
Yep, right when they opened, we moved in there. And we left there to go to Wabasha. But now we're in the beta cohort as well.
I don't know the beta cohort. Is it from Beta
Min? Beta Min, yeah. So Beta.min is an organization that started a few years ago. And so, you know, Startup Week.
It's one of the founders of Startup Week, or
exactly.
co-founders.
Exactly. So there's these two, like, major anchors for Startup Week, the Beta Min Showcase and Mini Demo. And so this is actually my second Beta Min Showcase. I'd done it previously with an earlier Minnesota company I did called Remo.
Right.
Then called Playtobase, and this time I was there with Clutch. And so now Clutch, the program now is bigger than it was 4 years ago, or five, however many years ago it was when I went to the first showcase. And now there's like an expanded kind of six-month incubator-like program. So technically we're in a one-year incubator in St. Paul and a six-month incubator in Minneapolis.
Well, you're going to be done pretty quick. It's like cooking your turkey in two ovens.
It's a little odd for an early stage company to have offices in two major cities.
Wow.
That speaks to how successful your company is, though.
Do you feel honored or do you feel schizophrenic?
Well, we only just entered the beta cohort, and we've only been in Lunar for a month. So,
It's too soon.
Fortunately, it's all on the green line, so it makes life easy.
Oh, yeah.
Jasmine Russell is in.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Monocat Data.
Yeah. So yeah, I just spoke at the Yellow Summit, which I know you guys covered. Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we were one of the media sponsors for Yellow Summit. So now your topic, you didn't go there and talk about Target and its agility. And
no,
its,
you actually sat in on my talk. So
I know.
I talked about creatives and how that relates to education and technology. And I actually Skyped in one of my very close friends who's an educator in D.C., and we talked about how schools, specifically schools that are in urban areas, are not preparing kids with technology skills due to lack of funding, money, lack of resources, and things of that nature. And he was a great person to speak to that. You know, I'm on the technical side, but I know a lot about education and what's not happening in our public schools in order to equip our kids with the skills that they need to be successful in STEM fields in general. That's something that's really near and dear to my heart.
Well, it's one of the great economic crimes and social crimes of our country, especially here in the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
They're crying for more skilled workers.
Yeah.
But again, they're don't even have the graduation up there.
Crying. I just tweeted about that this morning. I was talking about how people need to start taking advantage of the fact that we are in a place that they are begging for STEM workers. I just got off the phone with someone who was saying, like, hey, we have like five openings for engineers. Do you know anybody? Like, we can't beg. And then people who are getting job offers are declining them because other companies in other areas are offering more attractive, you know, benefits and things of that nature. So
there's a bidding war going on for talent.
Yeah.
There's a constant war for talent. And that's true for big companies. It's true for startups as well. You know, I mean, it's if you start to find success, then you also start to find messages on LinkedIn from bigger companies saying,
people have options.
Do you want to come over here and do our research, whatchamacallit department, or do marketing? Or, like, if you're doing well, people are paying attention. And the same is true. I'm willing to bet folks at Target, if they have a great quarter, it goes up. You know, I mean, it's pretty active that way. It's hard to hold on and find folks.
Well, tell me something about your different startups. I don't know the one about when you were four selling your mother's pots and pans or whatever it was, but
plants.
But, huh?
Roses.
You'd sell her roses?
Yeah, I didn't understand their value.
So, but you learned. So now, well, then your father played a role in your second startup.
Yes, that's true. So while I was in grad school, living in Dinkytown, my father had a series of strokes and heart attacks. And my dad's, he's a sales guy. Like, he'd walk into a room, shake everybody's hand, know everybody's name, big guy. And when he had the strokes and heart attacks, he lost his ability to take care of himself, to move around easily. He still had one good arm, and he retained his speech. His brain was still working, but it was painful. It was painful for him physically, and it was crazy for the family. And there I was doing a PhD in linguistics, and I'm sitting in class in syntax 2 or pragmatics or something, and I'm like, you know, the abstract theoretical difference between an adverb and an adjective just isn't that crucial when your dad is, you know, in and out of the hospital like that. And I had studied speech recognition systems and ubiquitous computing in my master's program, and I was super excited about it. I've always been like a big Star Trek fan, Star Wars, these kinds of things. And I used to watch Star Wars incessantly with my dad, superhero stuff. And I was like, you know, it would be great. I mean, I think a lot of people look at their parents and see kind of a hero, at least when they're little. And I was like, it'd be great if he had some abilities again, because he's so hobbled. And so I went into a mad fury and started ordering pieces of hardware and started working on a smartwatch back in 2012 before Pebble had launched, which no longer exists. Misfit. Mm-hmm. Fitbit was out. And so I just started working on building a band that would help him. And so there were two things I wanted to do. One, I wanted to track him through his day so I knew that he was okay. I could just open up my phone and see that he's fine or see that he's not moving and wonder what the worst is. And two, and this is no longer a feature for the company, but it is in our patent application, which is issued, is give him the ability to point at the electronics he wanted to control and wirelessly control them through gesture. So effectively what I invented was Fitbit for seniors combined with a mouse for the physical world. And this is before Amazon Alexa or HoloLens or I think Google Glass wasn't out yet. The smartwatches were crazy. Everybody in Minnesota was telling me I was not only could I not do it, but I couldn't do it as a person in the College of Liberal Arts studying linguistics.
So how do you take that challenge?
I didn't care about the challenge. I thought they were kind of off because I knew people out in the valley were kind of playing around with what we call connected devices, things like the Nest thermostat. And there were a couple of people in town who were also working on these kinds of things. Smart Things, which sold to Samsung for $200 million, a company called, now it's called Particle, that's since kind of moved out west but still has, I think, a little presence here. So I knew that there was a small community of folks who were tinkering with those kinds of things. But, I mean, innovation gets here a little bit slower.
Yeah.
And people...
You're on the North Coast.
Yeah, I agree.
So you're going to blow somebody's arm off, kid, you know.
Wow.
And so, while I was writing my dissertation.
Wow. And then it worked and you formed what? Remo was the first name?
Yeah. So originally the company was called Playtobase. And that was because we named the company based on the kind of company we wanted to build. But then we were doing senior care, and that was a totally bad idea. So we changed it to Remo, which is a remote monitoring solution.
Okay, so it works.
That is super cool.
And you have kind of your entrepreneurial side too,
yeah.
Brianna.
Yeah, so I am the founder of Brie Limitless. It's my own branded website, and what I do is I teach coding classes. So what I plan to move into is opening it up to more so the broader world. Minnesota is very, when it comes to like underrepresented faces, it's very kind of closed in. You know, it's very hard to find that niche when you're trying to teach coding and things of that nature. And then I have a full-time job. Like, I tell people that all the time.
You have a day job.
Yeah, I work in technology, but I'm a speaker. I do a lot of speaking engagements. I'm a volunteer. I love volunteering. And I teach people coding. Like, I have a workshop to do tonight. So it's in my entrepreneurial journey that just kind of turned entrepreneurial. I have had trouble kind of finding the time to take out and be like, hey, I'm going to put on a coding workshop and I want these kids or women or underrepresented people in general to come out. And I think that if I did it more web-based and had people, you know, call in, let's all do a Skype call and I'm going to share my screen and we're going to talk and we're going to get to connect with people from all over the world, I thought that that would be more beneficial. And that's why I created the website in general.
Website is called Bree.
Bree Limitless. So it's encouraging people to be limitless. Yeah. Bree Limitless. So my first name is Brianna. So I took the B-R-I to be witty. Make it catchy. Yeah. So it's Bree Limitless. And it just encourages women and kids to be limitless. Like, don't let people put limits and boundaries around you and what you can do, especially with being a woman in STEM. Like, I know the boundaries that are placed around me, and I'm not willing to live in them.
Boy, now, STEM, what does that stand for?
Science, technology, engineering, mathematics.
I just heard, like, a STEM, and then they had another.
STEAM. So science, STEAM? Technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics.
Boy, having a little aesthetics in the middle of science.
Yeah.
It's kind of shocking, isn't it?
Well, it's shocking until you realize that if you didn't have Wozniak, you wouldn't have the Apple computer. But if you didn't have Jobs, you wouldn't have the fonts, you wouldn't have the design. Mm. Like, it takes the myth of the genius, you know, tinkering around on some new kind of crazy idea, that's real. But in terms of making it a marketable product that people enjoy and becomes a part of their lives, you kind of need the artist.
I tell people all the time that designers are what drives companies. Mm-hmm. Like, how you design, like, nobody cares about what you're doing on the back end. Yes, it's going to make the front end work, and yes, but the traffic is really by the design. I don't know if you've got to see our newly remodeled Target stores. That type of aesthetic is built by designers. It's not built by the engineers.
And to be clear, so the front page you see on the website, that's kind of the front. But then there's a whole lot of stuff in the back that's kind of the brain of what you're seeing.
So I'm a back-end developer. Kind of a full stack. I can do front-end, but my main focus is back-end. But you'll never get to see what I'm doing behind the scenes.
You'll know if it fails.
Yeah.
If it fails the back-end, you'll know if it fails on the back-end because things just won't work.
Like, YouTube just had a big outage, and all I could think was, who is their on-call engineer right now?
But if it fails on the front end, then things you won't see it.
Well, I go to Target stores, so the front end is actually your shopping experience, right?
Yep.
Yes.
The way the aisles are set up.
The back end is the supply chain in the background to make sure the blender gets to the rack.
Yep. Right.
You know, you're talking about women's limits and women and everything. So last night I was in Nicolet Mall and I saw a young lady. She was holding this little pink thing, and I immediately said, "Oh, that's pepper spray."
Mm.
Right? It was late at night, walking down Nicolet Mall, which is a very visible area. And you know, she was ready. And it occurred to me as I witnessed that, oh shoot, you know, like I'm just standing there. But if I made a false movement, like she, chemical weapon in my face, right? If I just stumbled, you know, we talked about Clutch,
right? Well, tell everyone else about Clutch
for sure. So Clutch is a company I started not too long ago, and we make this product. It's called Clutch SOS, and Clutch is all about the personal relationships that we have, being there for each other, to be clutch for one another.
Mm-hmm.
The SOS stands for streaming witnesses who can hear what's going on, options to intervene so they can actually come and get you or yell at an attacker, and secure proof, which will survive even if the phone breaks or is damaged.
So let me see. If this woman with a little pink pepper spray, say you made a wrong move and she sprayed you, you could SOS somebody. Say, hey, I just got sprayed by this woman.
I actually had the app activated myself.
You did?
Nicolet Mall was heck of creepy.
You know what? I know someone in the startup community who would be interested in that.
Yeah.
They were working on something that sounds really, really similar. I'll have to connect you guys after
Sure, I'd love to talk with whoever.
Yeah.
Well, these days, I mean, A lot of people want to record their interfaces with police.
Oh, I do all the time.
That's definitely true.
I record other people's. I had an incident that happened, and I live in Eden Prairie for reference, but I had an incident that happened right outside of my house with young black kids. They couldn't have been older than 16 or 17, but all the police had their guns drawn.
Oh.
And the crazy part about it is, Eden Prairie, for reference, is a predominantly white area. A very privileged white area, may I add, but I immediately, all of the brown people, which there's three of us that live in the building, were on our balconies with our phones drawn, recording it.
Phones drawn.
Well, yeah, yeah.
But that also puts out a kind of dangerous scenario. So at Beta, we did something kind of unusual. We didn't just have some team members there. We actually had a user there to advocate for us who doesn't work for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a college student, she's a bartender, and her dad's a cop,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, you know, for us, safety is a holistic issue. But when I talk to police officers, one of their concerns is, let's say they're doing an action at night, mm-hmm. and they might have their gun drawn, but then they see somebody in the distance who has some dark object pointed in their direction.
Mm-hmm.
So It could be a cell phone.
Could be a gun.
It could be a gun. And so, I mean, safety is a tough thing. But, I mean, you know, that's the reason why the police have the body cam, so they can see what's going on.
Boy.
And so, you know, people, it's not, I don't know, everybody has moments where they don't feel completely comfortable.
So is clutch good for what other situations?
So clutch is good for your Tinder date. Clutch is good for your police stop. I have a lawyer in my clutch, SOS app. Absolutely. Why not, right? In case something goes down.
I'm drinking very hot coffee at McDonald's.
Well, I mean, I think they overpromoted that one. But, you know, you're walking home from work late at night, or you're just going through the parking lot. We have a number of users who use it for that.
So is it queued up to certain people? Like you say, your lawyer, I mean, you don't get your lawyer for that.
You choose your people. Your people. And then also we actually have some users who are from the Somalian Hmong communities who use it to for family who don't have great English skills.
Oh, okay. It can be a person at hand, a translator at hand.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Boy, this is fascinating. Now, we're going to take a break, and I think, Brianna, you have to run off to work.
Yes, I have to run back to work.
Because Target can't function without you. Oh, it's such a feeling of power and importance.
There's probably some truth to that.
Wish that was the case. Well, I'm sure they could figure it out.
We'll hold it as truth right here because, you know, probably the CEO of Target has you on his clutch SOS.
Brianna, I did just get off my on-call rotation as the on-call engineer, which was a weight lifted. Long story short, but when it feels that way sometimes. We are on call.
Well, we'll enjoyed having you on. We'll be back.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Mohammed, you'll have to help fill up the final section here on Synapse.
Pleasure to be on here with you.
Yeah, thank you.
Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
Okay, we're back. Synapse, Think Tank of the Air here, and we have we just have one person, but he can think enough for like a whole crew. We're here with Mohammed Abdurrahman, PhD. Do you put the PhD at the end of your name ever?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So this is something to be proud of to complete a dissertation.
No. So when it, no. Yeah, I mean, sure it is, I guess. But when I was leading that company, Remo, my co-founders and parts of my team, they were like, no, you need to put the PhD. You need to get used to it. And you need to do it. You worked hard for it. You should do that. And I was like, I don't know. I don't want to be like, no, you should do it. So
it adds legitimacy.
I don't know. I mean, I'm a brother in America. It doesn't hurt. but that it was actually my co-founders who were like, no, you need to do that. And so I started doing it.
So now is that a habit?
It's kind of a habit. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, now do you still
also,
teach?
Also, Muhammad and Abdurrahman are extremely common names.
Like right.
As first names and as last names. Like, Muhammad is like John in the rest of the world, and Abdurrahman, it could be a first name or a last name, and so it's common at least as, I don't know, like Johnson, or maybe Jared, which could be first name or last name. So like if you really put it together, if my name were like John Jared or something, like it could go either way. So the PhD kind of creates some order.
Okay, it creates some identity.
Yeah, that too, I guess.
Wow. And then Muhammad, there's like how many ways to spell it?
I guess it depends on where you're coming from. People from different parts of the world spell it different ways.
Oh, okay. So you can tell where someone's from sometimes by the spelling.
Yeah, everybody in Minnesota thinks that my name is spelled with an O and an E because so many Somalis have it spelled that way.
Right.
And I'm not of Somali heritage, so I'm frequently mistaken as Somali.
May I ask, what is your heritage?
Yeah, my family's been in this country since probably before the revolution. My father's side can trace back to around Washington's time.
Wow.
And I've got some Choctaw, some Cherokee, some Scottish, some Irish. And we also know a little bit maybe about the African tribes as well.
Wow.
But yeah, I'm a mutt. My family's been here since, you know, probably before Ellis Island was a thing.
Well, I'm sure. So you're like a world person.
I'm just American.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks are.
But because of your name, you're probably not treated like one.
That's true. I've been told to go back to where I came from by people who I knew for a fact were three generations or fewer in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've had a man in my family who was a part of almost every major American war.
Mm.
Which goes to what we were talking about earlier. It made it pretty easy when 9/11 happened to be like, okay, what do you do?
What do I do this time?
What do any of us do? I mean, it's an all-male college, right? So the testosterone there was through the roof, okay?
What was the reaction among the students? Was there anger or upset or?
It was everything. I remember, so before that happened, I had participated in a case competition. There's a competition of business students, and we were partnered up with people from different banks and big companies. Enron was there. Arthur Anderson was there. Right, it's just before the crash.
Right, before the crash.
And so my team was with JP Morgan, Chase & Company, because they were merging at the time. And we got third place, and I was a freshman. And I and another freshman were like, we were key players on this team that included juniors and seniors. So at the end, I talked with one of the guys from Chase, and he was like, you know, that was pretty impressive. I was like, okay, right? But then I got this letter from Middlebury College, which is one of the preeminent schools in America for learning foreign language. And I asked my mom, what should I do? Because I really wanted to, I believed investment banking was my future. And she said, well, you know, if you learn, go and learn German, that'll be with you for the rest of your life. But, you know, Trade Center's going to be there.
Hmm.
And so I went and I put everything into it. And I told people, I flew back and forth to Germany a couple times. And I told people, you know, we could be having World War III and I wouldn't know because I'm so focused on my studies.
Huh.
And when I came back, my mom took, she took this, you know, those little portable TVs that we used to have when, mm-hmm. when TVs were cubes. And she's holding it. And I'm like, Mom, you know, I don't need that. We're moving into my dorm. She's like, I don't need that. I've been super into studying. This is going to be a great year. I don't need TV. She said, you know how you said that we could have World War III and you wouldn't know? She plops it down. She goes, this way you'd know. And that was September 10th.
Moms are always right.
That was September 10th.
Gosh.
So that morning, somebody told me to turn on the TV. And then we went to class. And like we just had to go to class. But meanwhile, people were in the cafeteria like freaking out. And the kids from New York, they were just disillusioned. If you were from New York or New Jersey, it was really weird because here in Atlanta, or there in Atlanta rather, it was kind of cool, but it was mostly warm. But New York, it was September already, right? So they're watching it happen, and you know, everybody's trying to call their family, and then you have to go to class.
All right.
And my management professor's like, because I was taking business classes, he's like, I'm going to submit to you that this won't actually be a major defining moment in your life. And I'm looking, like, he's just trying to help us, like, contextualize
mm-hmm.
where things go. And I think he was trying to, like, make us feel better because we were all kind of messed up. because people immediately start talking about the draft and we're going to have to go, you know, bomb Mecca or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were so many things. You remember. And I looked around the classroom. It's all brothers. It's all black guys. And I'm looking around. I'm like, you know what? I'm the only guy in here with a fully Arabic name. I'm, you know, early, like late teens. This is going to mean a lot. Like, people are going to – this is going to mean a lot. And it's not – this is a big deal. And no matter what he says, that's not going to make it less of a big deal. It might not – I think it's going to matter for everybody, but it's just too much. And then when I saw the president say, you know, I can hear you, and those guys are going to hear us, I was like, look, you know, that could have been my aunt. That could have been me. There's people at that case competition who worked there.
At the World Trade Center.
Yeah. You know, there were Morehouse men there. There were Spelmanites there. It was. There were people who I had looked up to who were seniors, who were working there.
Mm.
Right now, when I was a sophomore, it was just too much.
Mm.
So, So, it's. I don't think it. I don't know. I'm just. Yeah. Never mind.
So it was. Well, so your professor was wrong. It was a life-defining moment.
Again, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's not a. I think it's a major moment for everybody. It's like JFK getting shot or the moon landing or something. It's a big moment in American history, and you can't. It's like Pearl Harbor. That's what people compared it to that immediately.
Right, and.
And it's how I became a linguist.
Wow. Well, that's a good story. But you know, I'm older and I've lived through a lot of these things, and it's strange that before and after, the world does change. It's different now. I mean, the whole idea of worrying about terrorists.
Yeah,
became big. You know, taking off your shoes and everything before you got into
man,
a plane.
That guy with the shoes.
It just the security is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I look at the big picture and see how much money is going into this. I get kind of skeptical. I just follow the money.
Yeah.
So I remember, I grew up on military bases,
mm-hmm.
and so I had visited Quantico. I'd lived there as a kid,
mm-hmm.
and I visited there before 9/11, and you could go out and walk everywhere.
Yeah.
And then after 9/11, all of a sudden everything is locked up. So they got all this money just to put locks on things, fences and
concrete
stuff.
Concrete fences.
And it was like whether it needed it or not, here's the money, go build something. And so I always worry about where all the money is going when there's so many things that need it. We heard Brianna talking about there's not enough computers to teach kids basic STEM skills in elementary
yeah.
school. And so Well, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, right? Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Wow, here talking with Muhammad Abdurrahman. I'm mispronouncing that. Is it one of the ways?
It doesn't. So, I mean, that's the thing is, like, I'm not an Arab myself.
Uh-huh.
So, like, it's not my language. And so, depending on where I am, somebody might call it Abdurrahman. As long as you get the consonants and the vowels sort of like,
as long as you get it out. Well,
if you mess up Muhammad, we got questions.
We got a problem.
Yeah, but.
Well, in studying linguistics, did you study a lot of different languages?
Absolutely.
How many, can you list them off a little bit?
The languages I studied?
Yeah.
No, I can't. I've forgotten a lot about a lot of little, like. So
some of the major ones.
Oh yeah, so German, Mandarin, Japanese, Russian, Arabic, Farsi, Korean, different kinds of English.
So those are languages that have different scripts also.
Yeah.
So do you get an idea that there's such a thing as concepts that exist regardless of what word you're attaching to it, or is in thinking different languages thinking different ideas too?
So I had a student come to me once when I was teaching at the U, who she was a Hmong, and she said, I feel bad, my language is inferior, right? And it was strange that she used those words. It felt like she had gotten them from somewhere else, actually. But I said, you know, why do you say that? And she said, well, I study biological science, and I'm studying microbiology and cancer and things of this nature. And I can't explain any of it to my mom, my grandmother. Like, there's no word in Hmong for this. That's what she said to me. And maybe she just didn't know it. Maybe there is. But I said to her, you know, English has a lot of shorthands for concepts that we use frequently. And this is common. If you ask the average person what laser stands for, they don't know. They don't know it. I think it's light amplified something or other, right? Mm-hmm. They don't know that. Same with a lot of other things that we've lexicalized, we've turned into words.
I like that word, lexicalized.
Well, yeah, it was an acronym, and now we use laser just like the same way we use the word cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Like cheese doesn't stand for curd something or other, right? Like
curd, handily.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that, or it doesn't come from that. And so I said, you know, can you explain it with analogies and metaphors? And she's like, it would take a page. I was like, but you could do it, right? So in order to get to the point where we can tell a vision, for example, tell a vision is a combination of vision and tele, you know, something that's far away.
Mm-hmm.
So we combine those two. In German, it's Fernseher, seeing and far. Fan is far, sehen is to see, Fernseher. So, you know, at first you have to explain the thing in a long way, and then eventually you get to a shortened form. I remember studying a language, I think I'm mispronouncing it, it's called like Tokpisin or Tokpisin. It's the language of Papua New Guinea. Excuse me if I mispronounced it. You can actually follow the development of that language. It's called a Creole. And the way it worked was they have English as kind of a vocabulary layer, and then the grammar of the language comes from one of the local languages. I think it's called Tolai, but I'm not 100% sure. And so in the English, you say something like, by and by this will happen, right? Well, that went from by and by to bumbai to like just by to just buh. And that's like an element in the language to indicate the future, right? So, and again, that's not my main area, but my point is that all these things kind of, you can compress them. Something that took a long time to say becomes easier to say. We used to say World Wide Web or surf the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Now we just say online or search.
Or the web.
Or web, right? And that's different, right? So we get there faster eventually.
Was she satisfied with your answer?
Yeah, actually she was.
Oh, good.
It's but one of my great joys as a professor.
Well, that was a good response. I mean, I'm of the view, well, I mean, you know, most words come from metaphors anyway, right?
A lot. I mean, I don't know. That's a hard one for me to answer. There's some words that come from metaphors. There's some words that come from kind of sound symbolism, something we called onomatopoeia.
Okay. Like buzz, bee.
Yeah. And then there's other things. There was an area that I was really interested in when I was a graduate student called kind of sound clustering. Has it ever occurred to you to ever wonder about why you have words like glitter, glow, glimmer,
glisten? They all have the same sounds.
They all begin with that GL, and they all refer to something with light. Doesn't that feel a little strange?
I'm glad to hear about that.
Yeah. So that's something I found very interesting.
Well, I mean, the thing that strikes me, I mean, I studied philosophy, so I wanted to trace all those words, and it back to their etymologies, their Indo-European roots. So spirit, breath, psyche, breath, animus, breath. Mm-hmm. I mean, boy, there's something about breathing that they associated with some sort of life force. I mean, some guy gets knocked down. Is he still breathing? Is he still alive? And then the idea of spirit kind of evolved from that.
Sure.
So you can see all this. And then now we take for granted there's these spirits, or at least I don't know if we do that anymore, but a lot of people did.
Some people do.
And truth is related to the word tree.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the feeling that a lot of these things, a lot of these concepts we just made up, but then people took them to be literal. Picking metaphors to be literal.
There's some primitives in the human experience that make these things possible, right? So, you know, I know that if I see somebody who gets hurt, that I will also feel uncomfortable, right? Unless I've trained that out of myself.
Become insensitive.
Yeah, to that issue. And so, you know, people have this empathy. And so for that reason, like hunger, there's going to be a word for that in like every language, even if it's a sentence and they, you know, like the concept is going to be there because humans feel hungry. there's going to be a concept for smells because humans, you know, can smell things. But there won't always be a concept for the same color or for the same type of thing.
So there's certain universals.
Yeah.
Just from being human.
Absolutely. So you have to have a word for this five-digited thing.
Like your hand.
Yes.
Like your hand. So we have that in common. One of the language things, we just have a couple minutes left, and so this is a big topic, but at least we can touch on it. But especially in politics, we're in a big political season now.
Yes.
The way you frame situations, you use words to conjure up an image to make something look good or bad. Language can be used to really control people's thinking.
I thought you were going to talk about something else.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
You can bring that up, whatever that
no,
was.
No, it's all right. Yes. So I've actually talked about this as well. So, and this has nothing to do with political positions. Okay. But if I make a statement that I'm pro-life and you're not with me, does that make you pro-death? Or if I'm pro-choice in the land of the free, right, and you're not with me, do you hate freedom, right? If I say that a man was shot today, or if I say a man violently attacked a bullet, right? Or if I say the rioters were shot versus the democracy protesters were shot, right? The wording definitely changes how either the perception or the position that people can be like find themselves in.
Or the feeling of sympathy, whether, that person deserved to be shot or that being shot was an outrageous thing, we should all be against it.
Correct.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So do you
But that's not my area. I don't shape language.
What were the thing you were gonna say?
No.
You don't wanna talk about that.
What is it? Well, you go ahead.
Well, no, we're just about out of time here. So just one final question. Do you have, I mean, linguistics is a huge, huge field.
Yeah.
Do you still dabble in it, even though you're on your entrepreneurial track and in two different incubators?
Absolutely. It's always a part of, I mean, the skills that you learn in analysis of something as meta as language are skills that translate to a lot of human interactions and it develops development. So, you know, when I'm developing a product in my doctoral work, I worked with human subjects. Like I that sounds kind of a little clinical, but but I interviewed people.
Right.
I had to talk with people. And so, you know, those things are relevant in the research around a product for so-called UX research, et cetera.
You have to pick a name for your company.
What do you mean?
You have to pick a name for your company.
Sure. But
Clutch,
I mean,
that means something.
Yeah, but Playtobase wasn't the greatest name for a senior care company, no, was it? Just because you study something doesn't mean that that's always your gift. It was a good name for when we chose the name, it made sense. We didn't know what the product was going to be when we chose the name for that company. Clutch, I really like the name Clutch.
Clutch
for this company.
SOS, is the app available?
Yes, it's available on iOS right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then we can close on that. It's available at your nearest iOS.
Yeah, Clutch SOS. Search the whole word Clutch SOS on the Apple Store, and you can try it out. It's
okay. Great. Thank you very much for being with us for the entire hour. Mohammed Abdurrahman, co-founder, I guess. Co-founder? Founder?
Managing co-founder.
Managing co-founer of Clutch SOS. And I'd like to thank our producer, Dan Culhane. And this is a co-production with WCCO Radio, our media partner. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget.
Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.